Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Monday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Judy Downey from the Relatives and Residents Association that supports people in care homes and relatives of them particularly. Also, Mark Smullyan from the band White Flag, one of the first bands to feature both Israeli and Palestinians. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, just off Queen's Square on 0117 989 7733. Or visit them online at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. We start this week with Judy Downey. She's the chair of the Relatives and Residents Association. Hi, Judy. Okay.
Hello. Hi.
And welcome to Dialect.
Thank you.
Can you tell us, first of all, what is the Relatives and Residents Association?
Well, the Relatives and Residents Association is a charity. It was set up by a wonderful woman about 20 years ago who was actually quite a posh civil servant. In fact, she spent her first job when she started out working with Nye Bevan, setting up the NHS. So she was very keen on public services being good and looking after older people. And when her mum went into a care home, she found it very good, but what she found tough, and I think we all still experience the same sort of thing, is that when she tried to sort of say what her mother needed or what her mother preferred, because her mother was very old and frail, and although she didn't have dementia, she wanted nobody to make a fuss and didn't want to say anything that might disturb anything. It was Dorothy's job to really say, my mum can't eat pasta, or she doesn't really like to drink out of a mug, and these are the things that she can and can't do. And she found it quite hard to have a good relationship with the home and yet stand up for her mum. And she had the sense to realise that it wasn't just her, but it was very useful for there to be an organisation that could help people with concerns or questions to kind of not make it as personal as it does. Because when I've had my mum in a care home and my mother-in-law, and you really want to get on with them and you want them to like you, and you want them to like your mum. But if there's something that goes wrong that you're concerned about, or even questions that you want to ask, the response often seems defensive. Not because people are nasty, but often you're asking the question of a care worker who might not actually know why things are the way they are. And we know here in our organisation what the regulations are, what your rights are as a resident and as a relative. We know what the regulations are. We know what they say about all sorts of things, about complaints or emergencies or food and drink or medicines or records or staffing, and we know the best way to approach it, and we can help people to do it for themselves and give them the power to do it themselves, or if they feel they can't do it, we'll do it on their behalf. And if the question and the complaint is serious, we raise it with the regulator, and we also try and make sure that the regulator follows it up.
What are the most common questions that people call in with you, call into to your helpline with?
Well, there's a huge variation. There's a massive, massive range of things that they phone us about. They phone us about problems with medication, problems where they think the standard of care isn't good enough, where they're worried that their people aren't properly protected. They're sometimes worried about what happens at meal times and if people are fed properly. They worry about sometimes the lack of staff and the lack of staff training. They sometimes are worried about, sometimes they ring up with really serious things like their parents not having been fed or changed or left wet or not being treated very kindly. But sometimes they are just very worried about raising something because a lot of people in the home are very good, and they don't want to seem to be difficult, so that if there's one particular member of staff who isn't very kind, they find it very hard to raise that. Sometimes they're ringing up about what they should pay and what the local authority should pay. Sometimes they might be entitled to the health service paying for their care, and they don't know, so we can advise them about that. I mean, there's a whole range of things, going from really serious, worrying complaints about poor care and some really quite what we would consider minor things, but cause people a lot of heartache. For example, we've had people ringing up who've looked after their mum, say, for years, and then they're terribly upset when they go and see her because she's not wearing her clothes or her hair is looking awful, and sometimes they get terribly upset and terribly angry. And we can say, well, why don't you speak to the manager, or we will on your behalf. And then the manager might say, well, why doesn't she come in and show us? And then you've kind of, there's often a lot of worry and guilt when your mum or your partner goes into a care home, because you feel you failed them because you just can't cope any longer, or they can't cope any longer. So, and we do a lot of listening. We do a lot of listening to people who are desperately upset, because if your husband does go into a care home or your partner, often you're suffering in your own way from missing them and from the loneliness. If you've been together for 20, 30, 40 years, it's a very big change of life for people.
Now, isn't this really part of something much bigger, which is that over the last, probably, we're probably talking about since the Second World War, many families before that would have cared for elderly people at home, maybe given up a job or gone over to something like part-time work to look after an elderly relative. And we've become sort of mollycoddled a little bit by the welfare state taking the responsibility off of our shoulders.
If only. I don't think that that's true at all. If when I first started work, people were considered old in their 60s, and if you lived beyond your 70s, you were considered really old. And, I mean, if you look at the age of retirement, I mean, you know, policemen were stopping work at 45, and it was a kind of complete... We weren't as healthy, we weren't as well looked after, we didn't have the NHS, and we didn't have often the longevity, the long life we have now. People going into care homes now aren't in their 60s and 70s. They're more often than not in their 80s and 90s and 100s. And they're not just a bit frail or a bit, you know, they've got a bit of arthritis. Usually they've got 70%+ of people going into care homes have dementia, and sometimes double incontinence, and sometimes heart and lung diseases and arthritis and Parkinson's on top of all of that. The population of care homes is now quite ill, quite frail, and often very confused in their mental state. I never thought that my mother, my beloved mother, who was a strong, tough lady, lecturing me even in her early 80s about what I should and shouldn't do with my children. Once she had her stroke and got more and more confused, and then, you know, I took her to live with me because she was upsetting the neighbours by ringing their bell at 3 o'clock in the morning. I put her in one of my children's rooms, and she couldn't remember where the loo was in my house, so she sort of peed in the corner of my daughter's bedroom, tried to wear my daughter's clothes, you know, who was a little girl at the time. I mean, you know, the doctor said to me, one of you will end up in intensive care and it won't be your mother. You know, it's pretty unrelenting looking after someone who doesn't know the difference between day and night and can't control their bowels anymore. It's pretty, pretty tough. It's not about not... And a lot of people are doing that day in, day out. And a lot of them, you know, just are at the ends of their tethers. It's very, very tough.
Now, the other thing, of course, is that over the last 10, maybe 15 years or so, there's been an increasing privatisation in this world. And whereas in the old days, it was seen as something that the public sector looked after, whether that be nationally or locally through local authorities. And now it's more and more the private sector. So I wonder how that has changed the way people and the quality of care people are getting, that elderly people are getting.
Well, it's changed in quite a lot of ways. I'd say that the physical standards have probably improved a lot. When local authorities ran most homes, one of the good things about them, and certainly not all local authority homes were brilliant, but one of the things local authorities did in the past was train their workers and also train the managers. And now that local authorities only run something like 7 to 8% of the care home sector, about 80+% is private sector, and about 12 to 14% is not-for-profit sector. It's largely the private sector that is supposed to do its own training, and we know it's just not happening enough. And the turnover of staff makes it quite hard, even for a good private sector provider, to keep on top of it. And you know, we think in the Relatives and Residents Association, one of the things we campaign for is for it to be a public sector responsibility, just like teaching, nursing, nursery nurses, teaching assistants. Why should the care home providers have to do the training? It's not transferable, and it's not good enough, and it doesn't provide a career structure so that people can be proud of what they do, have some kind of career progression, and, you know, develop their practice. The teachers who teach in Eton have been paid for by us, and the doctors that work in Harley Street, their education has been paid for by us. And, you know, we think that caring for the oldest, frailest, most vulnerable members of the community ought to be a public sector responsibility, and the government ought to not shy away from it.
So what are the sorts of things that have been going on within the private sector then, and what is it you think makes it so that, for example, they're not giving staff as good paying conditions and training as happened in the past? This is rather worrying if you're thinking that you know, that the actual quality of the staff is not so good as it used to be. And if so, why is that?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's what we heard about in the little budget the other day, isn't it? The public sector shrinking, local authorities being given less money by central government, and everybody having to cut their expenditure. So the local authorities try to spend less, and so the care home providers think they get less. We don't think that it's justifiable whatever people are getting paid by local authorities, that the care home providers don't provide carers with sufficient training and knowledge to do a really good job. But there's no mandatory training. There's a recommended 12-week induction. That's not enough, is it? I mean, you need more than that to be a hairdresser. You're doing a really complicated job in a care home. You're dealing with medication, you're dealing with a range of people, you're dealing with people who need sophisticated care and, you know, tactful care, and you're dealing with a range, as I said earlier, of some very difficult illnesses and conditions, most of which are progressive. So yes, it's. I think that unless, you know, we all shout for this kind of investment, it won't happen.
How open are these private sector elderly care homes to scrutiny?
Well, there's a regulator called the Care Quality Commission. When I first worked as in this field, all homes had to be inspected twice a year. Now the regulator says that it's only poor homes that are going to be inspected.
So they might never
often.
You're saying they may never be inspected if they're supposedly up to standards.
Well, they're going to do paper inspections of homes, perhaps once a year, perhaps more frequently, but they haven't made a commitment about frequency. There is no longer a law, a government regulation specifying the frequency. If you were in a children's home, it would have to be inspected twice a year by law. There is no specified frequency for the inspection of care homes, and we know that some of the homes that we have queries and concerns about haven't been inspected for 3 years.
And also, I know that their government is also dropping some of the rules for care homes. I mean, that sounds crazy since the rules are already pretty relaxed.
They're not relaxed. It's the way that the care regulator, the inspectorate, works that we're critical of. The inspectorate has more powers than the police. They can go in without a warrant at any time of day or night. They can take photographs, they can take evidence, they can interview people. What we are very upset about, and why we caused a debate to happen in the House of Lords about a month ago, was that the government has dropped three key regulations that we think were terribly important. The regulation saying that everybody must be told about the complaints procedures, not enough to say we've got complaints procedures, but people must be told that they're there, because the average relative and the average resident doesn't think first about complaining, but they need to be told that that they have a right to do this and what the complaints procedures are. They also need to know that there's a whole range of regulations governing care that they should know about, and the care home staff and managers certainly need to know about. And they need to know that, for example, in the old regulations, it said specifically that you must be given a choice of food. Now it merely says you have to have sufficient quantities of food and drink which are nutritional and balanced. And that was in the old regulation, but not with the old regulation you were told you must be given a choice. That's pretty important for people. For a lot of people in a care home, food is, often the most important part of the day. So we've been campaigning very strongly that we want those regulations reinstated. We also want the regulation that used to be there in the past, which made the provider have to write a report every month on what was happening in the care home, and somebody actually representing the provider, not the manager, but an independent person had to go in every month to check that the home was doing what it said it was going to do. So, and they had to write a report to the regulator, the inspectors, that means, and to their fellow directors, if there were other directors, and to the care home manager. And they were supposed to interview residents and staff and talk to people, so that the kind of scandal we had when the Southern Cross homes collapsed, where there wasn't enough heating, there wasn't enough food, and there wasn't enough staff in some of the homes when they started to run out of money. I mean, all the providers said, well, how could we have known? But if they'd had to do this regular reporting, how could they? They could have been prosecuted for not knowing.
Now, there's also recently been a case, hasn't there, where some relatives of an elderly person in care actually had to put a CCTV camera, install one in the room, and found that that their elderly relative was actually being abused by one of the people who was supposed to be caring for them.
Yes, we were actually involved in two Panorama programs. They were our clients who were featured in those Panorama programs. And the sad thing is that they had complained to the regulator. They had complained to the care home manager. They had complained to the local authority and got nowhere. So in desperation, they'd put the camera in secretly. But but what about those residents who don't have relatives? 10% of residents in care homes, we think, don't have any kith and kin or people in regular touch with them. We did a survey a few years ago showing that, and I don't think the situation's changed very much. That's 40,000 people with nobody looking out for them. And, if it was a child, you'd have to have a social worker. You'd be considered a child in need, and there'd have to be someone who reviewed your care regularly. Older people don't have that privilege.
That's quite incredible. Tell us a little bit more about the person who it was. So you didn't mention her name, that founded your organisation, who worked with the original welfare state creators back in the 1940s.
Her name was Dorothy White, and she was quite a character. You know what they say, if you want something done, you ask a busy woman. Well, she was one of those. And she actually felt that when she died, the 1997 Labour government had just been in power for a couple of years, and she was a sort of old Labour person, but she felt that they weren't giving enough importance to older people's services, either within the National Health Service or in care homes, and so she became an even stronger campaigner. But sadly, she died towards the end of the century, but she certainly made her mark on impressing upon everyone that met her that this was a cause worth fighting for, because she went to the other existing charities for older people, and they all said, oh, you don't need a charity like that. We're already doing it. But, you know, we're the only national charity that focuses entirely on residential care for older people, and we get... Throughout the year, we get hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people phoning us, and most of them are at the end of their tethers because it's taken them so long to find us because, you know, we're not a well-funded charity. And, you know, if any of your listeners have got relatives in care homes or are interested in the topic, we need more members, and we need, you know, even people who want to be on our mailing list or receive our bulletins so that we can keep them in touch with what we do. And, you know, we certainly need to spread the word about the rights of older people in care because, you know, compared with being in a hospice where there are massive resources, there are all sorts of specialties going in, there's physios and there's occupational therapists, and the drug regime is managed very carefully, and you get experienced doctors and nurses. I mean, in some care homes, there might not be more than one qualified person. That's really not good enough. You only get one chance of dying, and it ought to be, you know, the best possible experience at the end of your life, not a sad one.
Sounds like Dorothy's still quite influential through what you're doing. If you had the ear of the Secretary of State, or even, dare I say it, you were the Secretary of State, Judy, what one or two changes would you like to see to the current system in order to start making it work for elderly people? And particularly, I think you're right in pointing out there are so many elderly people in care who don't have a relative to check up on what's going on in their home.
Well, I'd do two things. I'd make residential care in care homes be financed exactly the same as the NHS. We don't understand why, if you've got dementia, which is a horrible progressive disease, you have to pay for your care or have a means test for your care, when if you have several cancers, one after the other, it's taken for granted. Whatever age you are, whether you're 18 or 80, the NHS will look after you, and generally pretty well, and generally with some expertise and up-to-date knowledge and equipment. We think that it's quite wrong, and it causes absolute havoc, just as we have now all this stuff about labelling older people in hospital as bed blockers. How dare we call people in hospital bed blockers when it's a question of the local authorities not being able to find a place or find the money for a place? If it was a child being kept in hospital for no reason at all, there'd be an outcry. If it was all one budget and paid for all by taxation, that wouldn't happen and couldn't happen, and we might get the kind of expertise and training that we get in other aspects of care. And the other thing that I would change, if I could, I'd have a plan for the training of workers in the care sector so that there was a proper training regime, a proper curriculum, and a two-year course like they have in some parts of Scandinavia, which you got qualified in, and you know, did a mixture of practice and learning and got qualifications, and so that we'd have a qualified, respected workforce, because now we know from research that the vast majority of those wonderful people who work in care homes and do a jolly good job most of the time don't even confess to being care workers because of all the stories about abuse in the press. And that's really sad. You know, people don't actually admit to working in a care home. And we've done a lot of work. We've produced something called Keys to Care because we were so worried about the way that care workers got trained, and they're sort of little plastic cards on a ring that are laminated called Keys to Care, and they cover 12 topics about care, going from dementia to listening and talking, or continence care, or care plan, and care at night. And we've, with money from Comic Relief, we've produced those, hoping that the care homes would buy them and use them. But on the whole, we found small care homes might buy them, and a lot of relatives are interested in them. And, you know, we hope that, you see, it also helps care relatives know what should be done in the care home, because a lot of them don't even know what to expect and what should happen. For example, they don't know necessarily that the care plan should involve the families and should include details of medical information and people's needs and preferences about their family and friends, about identified risks, about the goals, you know, and positive things about the resident or prospective resident. And also it gives permission to the kind of care worker to ask questions about the care plan, say, because a lot of the care plans might be kept in the manager's office, and if the care worker who's on duty doesn't know what's in it, they can't do their job very well, can they? So you know, we give them their kind of little hints and tips, and so we don't just moan, we do stuff to make things better.
Just finally, Judy, is there anything that you think that relatives should be looking out for if they're visiting their elderly friend or loved ones in a care home? Any sort of telltale signs that you think may possibly indicate that they should take a closer look at the care that's going on?
Well, I think that if they're looking for a care home or looking or somebody's already in the care home, we think the most important thing is the relationship, just as it is for those of us who aren't in care homes. What the atmosphere's like, how go at meal times and see how people are fed, if they're being helped kindly and nicely and not left alone to eat if they've got a tremor or if they've got dementia. I mean, people with dementia often think they've eaten when they haven't, or sometimes want to eat too much because they can't remember. So if that's done kindly and, you know, with proper one-to-one care and concern, that people look happy and relaxed, not nervous and worried, that the people who might be a bit immobile are helped to get up and out, that there are things going on in the care home and people coming in and out in a friendly, happy and relaxed way, and that, you know, if you ask about something, people respond in a friendly, relaxed way and aren't immediately defensive and worried. I mean, we've had a lot of relatives who've asked perfectly reasonable questions and then been told by the manager, well, you know, if you're not happy, you know, here's a month's notice. And people don't want that. They want a good relationship. But it's important to look and listen and, you know, get in touch with us if you think there's something that you need to know a bit more about. And if you're, you know, seriously worried about something, get in touch with the regulator or get in touch with us and we'll refer it to the regulator. Don't put up with rubbish, you know, expect the best. And, you know, but obviously treat the staff with the kind of politeness and decency you would like to be treated with. But and ask to see the person in charge, because the care worker won't necessarily know. There might be an agency worker who hasn't been there very long. So don't, you know, just as you wouldn't, you know, ask the first person you met in a school about what the school policy was. Don't assume, you know, and don't assume the worst, and assume that the people there are there to do a good job. Don't get up in the morning to do harm, but don't accept rubbish, don't accept poor care, and, you know, stand up for your relative in a decent, polite and honourable way.
And if you want to know what your rights are, I could suggest that people get in touch with you, Judy.
Absolutely.
info@relres.org. That's info@relres.org. And that's also your website, relres.org. And I know you've got a helpline too, haven't you?
Yes. That's 0207 359 8136.
Okay.
And it's 9:30 to 4:30, Monday to Friday.
Okay, so that's 0207 359 8136. So, Judy Downey, Chair of the Relatives and Residents Association, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you for inviting me. Bye bye.
We'll also give the number again at the end of the programme.
Brilliant.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And now Angela Balassi joins us again. This week she interviews Mark Smullyan, who was a member of one of the first Palestinian-Israeli bands.
I am joined by Mark Smullyan, a musician who is part of the Israeli and Palestinian band White Flag. Mark, who moved to Israel at the age of 12 with his family from London, helped set up the group in 1998. Mark, who now lives in Bedminster, Bristol, said the band defied borders and politics. They even risked their lives to make music together. Hello, Mark. Thank you for joining me. Can you tell me how the band came about, please?
Hi, Angela. The band started, there was a charity, NGO in Tel Aviv, 1998, who wanted to do a fundraiser. And they invited a lot of Palestinian musicians to come to Tel Aviv, and there was a spontaneous jam session with Israeli musicians from Tel Aviv. It's not so easy to get the musicians from Gaza. It sounds quite easy, but it was a long process, bureaucratic process dealing with the military authorities. But in the end, the musicians came. We had a wonderful evening. Money was raised for the charity, and it was decided to do it again a couple of weeks later. And after the second performance, which was musically more stimulating and interesting, six of us, three Israelis and three Palestinians, decided it would be a lot of fun to carry on, and we formed the band White Flag.
We're now going to play one of those songs. Could you introduce it, please?
The first song we're going to play here is a song called Isan. Isan means horse. The song is in Hebrew and in Arabic. The song is about a horse being free. The horse doesn't have to worry about crossing borders. The horse doesn't have an identity card. The horse doesn't have to show that it has a right to exist.
Social orders, just the pumping of their life force as they race the desert winds.
That was Issan by White Flag, and I'm joined by band member Mark Smullyan. What challenges do White Flag face?
The Palestinians were living in Gaza. For them to come into Israel was almost insurmountable. We had to get permission from the military for them to come in. They had to go through severe border and control, and they were body searched and quite often quite humiliated as well, laughed at for coming to make music with the Israelis. They had to come into Israel and outside of their comfort zones, rehearsal rooms they'd never been in before, ways of making music they were unfamiliar with. So everything to them was a new experience. Everything to them was sometimes exciting, sometimes humiliating, sometimes distressing, all of it new and different.
I understand you became good friends with the group, is that fair to say?
Absolutely.
And also understand you actually smuggled a bandmate out of Gaza. Could you tell me about that, please?
One of the musicians was accused of being a collaborator by the local authorities in Gaza, for a collaborator with the Israelis, which meant that he was ostracized in the community and threatened with jail and severe punishment. So he managed to get out of Gaza, come into Israel. But in Israel, it was a period of time during the second uprising, what they call the Intifada in 2001, and he couldn't actually stay in Israel. So he... legally. So he stayed with us illegally for about 10 months in our apartment in a little room upstairs. And we did a lot of internet work and a lot of music together, actually, and the family had a good time. And he was a wonderful babysitter. But after a while, we realized it was getting too dangerous, because if he had been caught, my family and I and he would have got into deep trouble. So we managed to get him into the West Bank, which is not Gaza, into the West Bank. But in the West Bank, he was recognized immediately as being not a local. They, who was arrested by the local security forces, thrown in jail, given a very, very hard time. I don't want to go into depth about it. Given a very hard time, released after 10 days when they said to him, well, you're not actually a collaborator, but you're a bit of an idiot for playing with these guys. We don't understand why you're showing any sympathy or joy or desire to work with them. They're our enemy, kind of thing. As he came out of the jail, another security force stopped him and said, listen, we want to interview you. And he said, well, I can't come now. Can I come on Monday? And it was a Thursday. And they said, well, okay. And he called me up. I'd given him a cell phone. He called me up and said, Mark, if I don't get out of here, they're going to put me back in jail and I'm not going to come out of it alive for the next time. So a few of us, close friends of his who had some connections with different people in Israel, managed to get permission for him to come into Israel for 24 hours. Then he stayed with us for 24 hours. And in the meantime, we managed to persuade some organization in Switzerland to invite him to a peace conference that actually was only happening 4 months further on, but they kind of changed the date. And so the embassy gave him a visa, and he and I on Sunday morning flew to Switzerland. And it was quite miraculous, actually. It can give you faith in, I don't know if in God, but in the power of humankind if they put their mind to it to make things happen.
It sounds like quite an unusual friendship, because I understand you'd taken part in the military. What was that like?
For me to change, not for me to rise and look back on my military, I was a paratrooper, and realise that I'm sorry I did a minute of it, and all sorts of understanding that I had, was a long journey, in the same way that it was a long journey for Shadi and other Palestinians to say, okay, I'm not... Not every Israeli is a monster here, but it's more about governments and politics and situations and history. And to get past this emotional state for all of us was not easy. But when you do, there's a bond which is stronger than maybe just meeting in the local pub, you know, and becoming friends.
What was it like when you took part in military service?
Well, I was fortunate that I was in the army during a time where it wasn't quite as violent as now. It was a kind of 1976 I went in the army. It was quietish. There'd been the Yom Kippur War in 1973, and people were kind of not looking for a fight at that point. It was right before the first peace treaty that Sadat, the Egyptian president, made with Israel. But nonetheless, armies are armies, and I was a paratrooper in the Israeli army, and I found myself in situations that I was not happy with, if it was chasing kids during curfews or if it was other stuff like that. And for me, it was the first in a series of kind of mini epiphanies that changed not who I am fundamentally, because I'm a humanist and I always have been at heart and I believe in equality, but understanding that I had to be proactive if I wanted to see change come to that part of the world.
Did White Flag come about because you had wanted change?
White Flag came about because of my willingness and the other people's willingness to take part in trying to make change.
And how did playing music together have an impact?
Music is about equality. You can't make music together unless you're equal. You can't make music together unless you're working as a team. There is no leader in music. Even conductors aren't leaders in a traditional sense. But this is a rock and roll band, crossover kind of ethnic rock and roll band, where we're all the leaders and equal, and it makes everybody participate. And when you're participating like this together, borders and barriers and things which you've taken for granted as being maybe something that could come in between you kind of melt away, and something larger and more special than the inequalities of mankind to mankind kind of raise their head.
And you've lived in Israel for over 30 years. What is your point of view on the Palestinian-Israeli situation?
I said before, I'm a humanist. If there's no equality for the Palestinians, and there's no equality for the Israelis. The situation is very simple. We are, one of the reasons I left Israel was because I felt that the country was becoming a place, an unsafe place to live in, not just physically, but also emotionally. As the fear sets in, and as people get scared of what's going on around them, racism raises its head. There's second class and first class citizens, and I'm very sad about what's going on over there. I love that place. I wish I could stay there, but it's not a place where I feel I can't breathe. There, I feel totally choked over there. And sadly, I don't see a resolution in the near future, so I decided to pick up my life and carry it on so I can do the music. To me, music is my passion, and I want to be able to do that in my life.
What do you think it would take for a resolution?
Some great leadership, and for the countries of the world to make it clear that they're not going to blindly support anybody because of ideals, or in this case it's more about money and arms sales, actually. The belief that Israel is a kind of stable democracy in a sea of madness, and all of that's absolute rubbish. It's all just political spin. What it will take is peace will come when everybody wants peace there. Right now, not everybody wants peace. There are people making a bunch of money.
And what are you doing now in Bristol?
I'm working as a musician. I'm a producer. I'm a producer who has gold and platinum record credits as a music producer. in the world music and crossover between rock and jazz and classical and ethnic music. So I do that. I play. I'm working with a band with a wonderful Senegalese artist called Amadou Djian. And we're on the road more and more. And looks like we're going to be touring quite a lot in Europe and Asia as well in the near future. My other main passion is developing and promoting this new workshop thing I have called Lydian Stream, which is about understanding and taking advantage of the emotional skills we use in music in non-musical situations.
And I understand you've used that for children in St. Paul's, is that correct?
We've used that here with Salam Shalom, which is an organization, a charity that reaches out to different groups from various ethnic backgrounds and brings them together and to try and create opportunities where people can learn to meet one another and thus take away their fears of the unknown.
And how does it benefit people?
Lydian Stream is a higher level of communication. It's a more equal and honest and balanced level of communication. The importance of the individual and respecting one another's uniqueness and individuality and bringing that together as a group. What's great is that we can use most of this stuff in most situations, from the classroom to the boardroom.
Where can people find out more about Lydian Stream?
Like everything in our 21st century, from my website, www.lydianstream.com. Lydianstream.com.
Thank you, Mark.
And thank you, Angela.
We're going to finish with a song. Could you please introduce it?
Talk is a reggae song with a mad Arabic kind of riff in the middle, and it's all about communication.
Entwine all the edge of a globe.
was Talk by White Flag.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
He's been off for a few weeks, but he's back. It's Jeff Sparks with the What Song Guide.
Thank you, Tony. Hello, this is your What Song Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 12th of December, Raging Speedhorn will be performing with support from Sworn to Oath at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance and doors open at 7pm. On to Song of the Week, and I present T-Rex. This group formed in 1967 and split up 10 years later in 1977 due to the death of Mark Bolan. In their career, they released 13 albums, four of them under the name Tyrannosaurus Rex, and numerous singles. This is from the compilation album Bolan Boogie and is titled Woodland Rock, which was originally released as a B-side to Hot Love.
T-Rex with Woodland Rock from the album Bolan Boogie, which was released in 1972. Into Saturday 13th of December, Combi Christ will be performing with support from William Control and also Naked Lunch at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £16 in advance and doors open at 6:30pm. Finally, on Sunday 14th of December, the Wurzels will be performing their Christmas show at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £11 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11am every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Judy Downey from the Relatives and Residents Association, and her helpline number is 0207 359 8136. Also, thanks to White Flag Band member Mark Smullyan and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
Thank you.